Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
What does the future hold for St. Louis, and how do we get there? This is Nothing Impossible. Sponsored by Spark St. Louis. Creative space, igniting ideas on KMOX.
Well, welcome into this edition of our Innovation Conversation. Michael Calhoun.
And Travis Sheridan. And I hope you're hungry, listeners, because we're talking a lot about food today.
Yeah, we're talking about a group called Food City. It's an initiative of serving our communities. And a friend of the show, Darren Jackson, who's done a lot of great stuff in St. Louis over the years. This is his latest project, and we're excited to get into it with him.
And, you know, we talk a lot about entrepreneurship, of course, on this show, innovation. And we often will talk about some of the pitch competitions that go on in town, whether it's Capital Innovators or Arch Grants. But we haven't really been able to talk much about people that are pitching food ideas, whether it's a new way to deliver food, new food products, or new food solutions for food for food deserts that exist in the region. And today we get to with Darren.
Yeah, it's exciting and important stuff, and we're excited to get into it with him. We've got a lot to get to when it comes to St. Louis innovation, so stick around. We'll take a break and be back right after this.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
St. Louis Innovation with Michael and Travis. Nothing impossible on KMOX. Sponsored by Spark St. Louis. Creative space, igniting ideas.
Well, as we continue on KMOX, Michael and Travis with you, let's talk about St. Louis as a food city, Travis.
St. Louis absolutely is a food city. I mean, there's a lot of foodies here. We have a lot of great restaurants, but there's also a lot of burgeoning and growing, like, groundswell of entrepreneurs who are doing things in the food sector, specifically looking at consumer packaged goods, CPGs for short, getting foods onto people's tables and into the stores. And we're going to talk with Darren Jackson. He's one of the co-founders and organizers behind Food City STL. Darren, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
So Darren, first of all, tell our listeners what Food City St. Louis is.
Yeah, so Food City is we launched Food City. It's a program under our organization, Serving Our Communities Foundation. We started this foundation with the founders of Nature's Bakery after they sold their company. And they had a site in St. Louis, or a warehouse with 400 employees. And when they sold their company, they wanted to stay invested in St. Louis. So we partnered together to launch Serving Our Communities, which we've done a number of projects. And Food City is this initiative that we launched to really begin to understand where the gaps are within the food ecosystem within St. Louis, both for entrepreneurs, for farmers, for consumers, and for those living in food deserts. And so as we wanted to both understand those needs and catalyze a community around the solutions, we launched Food City. So we have a grant out. We had a grant out for $150,000, where it would be broken up between four different sections. And our goal was to really begin to understand who exists in these areas, what solutions exist, how they're filling those solutions, and what support they need. And we're also doing a huge survey right now. We're trying to get everyone to fill out so that they can help us to also understand the needs. So next year we'll put a report together and we'll start talking about what ongoing programming we'll have based upon the needs that surface from the research that we're doing. But we're really excited. We have a party on November 30th, so we're going to be celebrating all of the wins.
You know, I didn't realize that Nature's Bakery was a St. Louis brand, and that it was sold, and then that this family took the took that core, I guess, and decided to do something good, and do something direct to the community, as opposed to, you know, maybe starting another business or something like that.
Well, that's right, man. Well, they did kind of like both, actually. So their family's from Nevada. They have a place in Nevada. But St. Louis was really became a home. I mean, it was 400 employees here. They had to really start to care about the needs of the employees. I mean, whenever they moved in, and then so they started to care about where the communities were coming from. And so, yeah, so that became really important. And actually, they did kind of like a dual investment. So on one side, we have Serving Our Communities, the foundation. We also have Serving Our Communities in LLC. And we have the family also. So Dave, the husband, started a plant out in Florissant called Marson Foods. And it's about 150,000 square feet. It's all automated for the most part. And the goal will be to put a lot of food through there, and also to start to look at what it looks like to develop a workforce through there, too. So when we look at the ecosystem as a whole, we're looking at all the way from consumers, the workers, the entrepreneurs, the farmers, all the way around. And we want to create a system that both cultivates and accelerates each one of these people and meets their needs as best as we possibly can and make sure that they have access to solutions. So yeah, they're all around, man. I mean, the Marston family has definitely decided to be sold out for St. Louis. They bought a house here and they're committed. So
that's going to be
awesome.
An interesting balancing act, I guess, or trying to weigh the pros and cons in terms of automation, because it could bring down the cost of food, make it so much more accessible for people to be able to get it. But then also on the flip side, you don't have the jobs that are behind it. And so you might have fewer people who are drawing the paycheck to be able to afford it in the first place. How do you take a look at a situation like that and weigh, I guess, the pros and cons of each side?
No, I think that's an awesome question. So, you know, the reality is the workforce is changing. The workforce is there's just a 2030 jobs report put out by the World Economic Forum, if I'm not mistaken, and talking about the future of jobs, the future of work, and the need for our upskilling and getting people into automation. So one of the big things with Marston Foods in this new facility is looking at programming and teaming up with people locally. We're not going to announce anything yet on this station, but to identify the best ways that we can begin to upskill the current workforce to make sure that they do get access, not just to Marston Foods, but to as many different of our employment partners as possible, because we need people who are trained in machine operations. We need people who are behind the scenes in this automation space. It's awesome that we could have people these days go through a boot camp and get onboarded for design related jobs in 3D design, who are creating products and parts for even the machines that will go towards making food. So I think that one of the coolest things is having more and more, not just businesses who are switching to automation, but who are equally as vested into the workforce development pipeline that will come through to make sure that people have the opportunities that they need.
Well, one of the things that I find fascinating, and back when I was still in California, I worked for an organization when we commissioned a report, and the output of that report was that over a 10-year period, this was agriculture-related jobs, that the number of jobs in agriculture was going to decline, but the average rate of pay was going to increase. And I would imagine the same thing is true with food processing and manufacturing, that we will, due to automation, we will need fewer jobs, but there will be more. And there'll be better jobs, higher quality jobs as a result of that. Like you said, Darren, some more on the programming side, more on the logistics side, more on managing the machines themselves as opposed to, you know, turning the switches manually.
Yeah, and this is the thing. This is another thing, is that these jobs become more equitable, okay? Like, these jobs
Absolutely.
Are made for these jobs are made for people who aren't necessarily able-bodied to pick up 50 pounds or more, okay? And they still can have a blue-collar job and have a livable wage. And so I think that that's one of the beauties of it. But also, one of the areas that we're looking at too is as we're creating and hopefully demonstrating the demand for this workforce, you can look at all across Missouri, like even there is a huge need for right now for people who have these skills and a need for upskilling. So even before thinking about how few of jobs there will be, the reality is there's a lot of jobs open right now, and we need to think about how to get people upskilled. And that isn't going to be all your job training programs, right? We need to have workforce partners who are dependent on developing this workforce, participating in the training and the upskilling, and invested into that. And we supposedly will see more of that. But I know that through our programming, we're really hoping to demonstrate it as well.
Well, Darren, Food City just recently had a pitch competition. And, again, as an outsider, I've been in St. Louis for almost 12 years now. When I first came here, I was introduced to things like gooey butter cake, toasted raviolis, Emo's pizza, maybe a Gus's pretzel. Like, there's a lot. St. Louis has a good food history. But at this pitch competition, we got to see some of the future of food, didn't we? Like, tell us a little bit about some of the companies and some of the entrepreneurs that pitched over at the pitch competition.
Yeah, I think that without name dropping anyone yet until we get to the selection announcement, I think that some of the type of stuff that we got to see, I do think it was really interesting. It was surprising. I got to look at all the applications as they came in. We had several of them come in. But some of the people, like, so we had an innovation grant, right? And so, like, we got to see some of these concepts where people were looking at the future of protein, like if by 2050, right, we're all needing more access to protein and having less access to it via meat, there's other ways that you can consume protein. And so we got to see some really cool innovative projects that people are working on and addressing both climate and food insecurity. While at the same time, we saw people bring in some like hometown favorites. I mean, even just some like hometown hood favorites on my end. Like, we got to see some like multi-filled egg rolls, okay, like, which was pretty awesome. We got to see my favorite. We got to see some toasted raviolis. I love toasted raviolis. So we got to see all kinds of really cool St. Louis classics, along with some pretty cool social enterprises, some farms. We saw lots of farms who were applying for both the climate and the Food for All grant. We saw people who were trying to come up with innovative models to grocery stores in spaces where people didn't have access to grocery stores. So making sure that people have dignity all around. I mean, the entrepreneurs in St. Louis are super unique in the fact that, in my personal opinion, and the fact that they just care about the community. It isn't like secondhand. It's baked in to their processes to care about their neighbors. And it just makes this project, I've worked on lots of projects all across St. Louis, and this has been one of the most, filling, pun intended, and fulfilling projects that I've ever gotten to work on. And so it's great just to see the community all around.
Darren, maybe people are thinking, I think we've heard Darren on Nothing Impossible and on KMOX before. Take us back a little bit through some of the initiatives you've been involved in and some of the reasons people may have heard you on the radio before.
Yeah, man. I think maybe last time we talked, if I'm not mistaken, I was and still am looking at how to address the inequities of workforce, right? So I was sourcing talent, doing some management consulting, and working on projects that focus on establishing a more inclusive 21st century workforce. So working with groups like Meta, working with Block and Square across their products, working with Adobe. We still do a lot of work with Adobe, still do some work with Square. So yeah, the big focus that I've been on, and again, I feel like I can speak even more to the fact that how we need this upskilling right now. These jobs are happening. These companies are advancing. Automation is here. And it's just time. We got to get people trained. I also, at Mission St. Louis, I started the Beyond Jobs program when I was 19, 20 years old, helping create a workforce for people who were previously incarcerated. And it's still going and growing, and it's far better than anything I could have made it into. But yeah, I've been around the workforce space for a long time and looking at all the different angles, create a loop with our education program, teaching kids how to code. We have coding clubs all across the St. Louis area, including WashU. David Carandish is leading it now with Sharia Dunlap. She's amazing. Again, something far greater than I can do there. And I'm hoping that Food City also just continues to be this catalyst that brings together both community. And we look at some of these, you know, economic development challenges and workforce development challenges and how we can bring in, you know, and begin to build up pipelines, both with solutions and with people. So I'm kind of invested 360 all around this. I'm super interested in seeing solutions happen.
Well, Darren, it was I had the privilege of participating as one of the judges for the Food City pitches. I will say, Michael, it took all of my willpower to not consume all the samples that were being put in front of me. I mean, I think I had a cookies and cream toasted ravioli just staring me in the face. I think there was two different types of cheesecake staring at me. So Darren mentioned the reinvented and reimagined egg rolls, and that was there was some coffee that was imported by young people from Costa Rica. It was sitting like Man. Everything was right there. And what I loved about these pitches is that Darren hit the nail on the head, that these the entrepreneurs spoke just as much about the community as they did about the product. And I think that that's very different than when we go to maybe more, let's call them more tech pitches or demo days, where it might be very mm-hmm. product focused. This was really great to see the mix of the product and community.
I think that that's a good point too. I mean, I've worked a lot in the tech ecosystem in St. Louis and seeing a lot of, you know, being around the entrepreneurs, and obviously there's different needs. And they fulfill different solutions. However, I will say, man, like, I think that St. Louis, we're so saturated with really good food solutions. We have tons of all these factories, we have all these abandoned spaces. And I think that we are like, you know, we want to be this like Silicon Prairie thing for a while. And I think we're missing a huge opportunity with this advanced manufacturing and doubling down on it, saying like, you know what, like people don't want to move their tech companies here right now, or maybe they do, whatever. But I promise you, as soon as you demonstrate there's a workforce here, people will move their manufacturing facilities, right? Like I have some guys who we worked with, and I was with my friend Drew, who does a lot in advanced manufacturing and in St. Louis and around the country. And we were up in San Francisco with this group, Rapper Robotics, and we were trying to convince them, yo, you need to come check out St. Louis. They just opened up a huge facility in Detroit. And St. Louis is just like right on the cusp. We have everything we need. I think just staying focused on like where both this value that we could create to our local consumers but also to the national consumers, but that we could build in this like local buy-in with these companies, because man, we need manufacturing to be in St. Louis. I think we have both the talent in St. Louis, the opportunity to have that type of talent in St. Louis. We have all these job training programs. Everybody just focus. Like, you know, there's tons of needs here. You know, when we talk about advanced manufacturing, man, think about this. This is from design all the way through product, right? That's not just food advanced manufacturing. You get equipped in one, you get equipped in most, right? And so this is the future, man. And I think that, you know, even through Food City and through the work that we're doing, we really, really plan and want to be invested in on looking at this as a lane. And food is the easy way to stay in our lane. People just, you need, you know, in St. Louis, you know, I've been around for a minute, and I know it's best to just stay in your lane, to listen, see what's working, see what's not, and support the, you know, support the process. And I think that this is definitely a process. This is a part of the lane that we can definitely add value to.
Well, to Travis's point, food is a different different animal, you could say. I mean, the whole point of a meal is oftentimes is community, bonding with somebody. You go out to catch up with somebody over a meal. It's about nourishment. It's not impersonal, like an app on a phone. At its core, it's about connecting with people.
Man, exactly. We do monthly meetups every month already. We have a community manager, Keisha Mabry. I don't know how we got to be able to work with her. She's amazing. And we host a monthly gathering every month. We share a meal with the community. We listen to the community. We put $500 towards one of the organizations that are in the community. And then we also, whatever meal that we're having, we like to sponsor that from like a local organization that also creates exposure for them as well. So we are baking into our entire process the most community-centric approach that we could possibly do. We think that the people closest to the challenges are closest to the solutions. And so we plan on designing all of our programs, all of the solutions, all of our funding objectives being co-created with the community. So we're listening. People ask, hey, what's your plans right now? We say to listen right now, right? We see a lot of vision, but right now we're just trying to listen, develop. We'll announce next year in March what our plans are after our report. But yeah, man, the community aspect of it. And the fact that, I mean, like you said, it's food, you know, it's like, let's break bread together. This is definitely an awesome adventure for us.
I'm wondering what you think about the distribution or the direct connection with the community. We've seen a lot of efforts at food deserts. For instance, Fields Foods in St. Louis did not work out. All those stores closed. Yeah. We've seen Chicago kind of bounce around the idea of maybe a city-owned grocery store. Somebody took a look at some examples of that in Kansas, though, found that they lose hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, city-owned grocery stores. Food delivery services, though, those boxes, for instance, are a big business, very popular now. What do you think is the future, and what do you think Food City might look at in terms of distribution, of getting to the people, especially where they don't have access to food now?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's one that we're still being guided on through our own research. But I will say that there are some things that are surfacing that seem to be solutions that maybe we hadn't considered before. So, for example, and Travis can speak to this as well, is there's a growing number of local farmers and community organizers within communities where there are food deserts, and they are feeding people directly. There are a growing number of their food banking that are looking at better, more nutritious food options when food banking. There are people who are, we got to hear from a woman who is helping other women start farms within their own homes or in their backyards. I don't think that, I'm not gonna pitch a solution right now because I have no idea, but I do think that one interesting thing that we're seeing is we know this to be true. People take food from people they trust, and the people in their neighborhoods are starting to give out food and build up these farms and build up these solutions towards food. Some of them are farms, not all of them. Some of them are just basically like food banking or grocery. And I'm not sure what the solution is yet. And I don't, like I said, I don't want to speak to it. But I do think that one of the beautiful things that we're seeing is while people are figuring out how to bridge these, close these food deserts and get food into these spaces, the community is coming up with their own ideas and they're making sure each other gets fed. And I think that there's something really beautiful about seeing that and watching it. And I think that what will be sustainable is what the community can do and not what's always like and what can be done with the community, not for the community. So I think that as we look at how to invest, we need to look at how much we need. We always look at how much ownership the community has over a project or a solution, because we believe, you know, on our end, that sustainability is going to have community-based ownership, community voice, for it to be sustainable. And so I think just dropping grocery stores in people's neighborhoods and thinking, man, we got to fill food, you know, that people are just going to, you know, jump in. And I love Phil's Foods personally. I would have been a customer. But there's some retraining. There's some trust. There's some monetary gaps. There are all these things that are also true and relevant. And I think that communities who are designing solutions to this, they know what those users, what those customers need already, and they're designing for those solutions. And I think that what we're going to look at is how to get behind those solutions designers for where they are. Maybe it becomes not so scalable in the same way that we do look at tech. Maybe it becomes more of a this neighborhood needs something different than the next, right? And like one food desert solution might not work. Like the food desert solution in the south side might not be the same desert solution that we find on the north.
Oh, Darren, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting as we were listening to you talk and as we were talking through all this, all we were using were like food-based metaphors. I think you said that, you know, it fills you up. We talked about something at its core.
Breaking bread.
You know, when ideas are baked in, and then you just talked about the farmers that are, you know, there's a growing movement of. So, you know, we can't get away from it. Food is everywhere around us. Darren Jackson, thank you so much for joining us from Food City, St. Louis.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
And we've got more Nothing Impossible after this on KMOX.
Now back to Nothing Impossible on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. Sponsored by Spark St. Louis. Creative space, igniting ideas.
Well, as we continue on KMOX, there's a headline in the Wall Street Journal that St. Louisans can relate to. It says America's downtowns are empty. Fixing them will be expensive. And joining us right now is Conrad Putzier, who's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And Conrad, you know, we just had a photographer for Expedia, the travel website here, said that St. Louis looked to be one of the emptiest downtowns that he had been in on his travels. What did you find while researching this article?
Yeah, and the data backs it up. I think according to cell phone use data, so basically tracking people using their cell phones, it seems like St. Louis actually has seen the biggest drop in downtown foot traffic since 2019 of all American cities, ahead of Louisville and Kentucky and ahead of Minneapolis. So there's certainly something going on there.
Yeah, you took a look at Minneapolis and Cincinnati as two major examples. What are those cities facing? Is it the migration of people to work from home and offices to the suburbs, or what else is going on?
Yeah, the big issue that these cities face is definitely remote work. So you have these office districts that are just geared towards commuters coming in, filling office buildings every single day. And now that people often have the choice to work remotely and don't have to come in every single day, you're seeing the obvious thing, more people deciding that I don't want to commute to the office for half an hour or an hour every day. I'd rather just work from home. And that is a huge issue specifically for cities where the downtown is all dependent on office space, right? You can think of American cities as sort of on a scale. Like on the one end, you have places like Miami, Las Vegas, even Manhattan that have a lot of tourism and entertainment where offices really aren't like the sole focus. But then you have downtowns where it's all about offices. And you go downtown and it's these office skyscrapers, it's parking garages, it's hotels that cater to offices. And those are the places like Minneapolis that have huge issues now, because if people don't go to the office, what else is left? There's really nothing left.
Yeah, you drew an interesting comparison to the 20th century transition from factories and industry in downtown areas and riverfronts like St. Louis and Minneapolis, that transition from factories to offices and now offices to, is it question mark? Is it residential? What does the future look like?
So the future, I think pretty much everyone agrees, the future is some version of a mixed-use neighborhood where you have offices still, because offices aren't going away, right? There'll just be fewer of them. Alongside apartments, alongside shops, parks, entertainment. And the idea is basically that those are the kinds of neighborhoods people want to be in, that are successful. And I think the blueprint are these former industrial areas, right? There's places like Williamsburg in New York, or in Minneapolis, you have the Mill District. These are areas that used to be just factories. And in the 1950s, 60s, and the decades since, those factories and mills all closed. And what replaced it over the years is basically neighborhoods where you have some loft apartments, some new office buildings, and lots of bars, breweries, restaurants, parks. And they're doing pretty well. And they're successful in part because people are able to live there and also work there. They don't have to spend all day in the car commuting back and forth. And the vision for office districts is to kind of replicate a version of that, to kind of find that same success.
What are the struggles, though, with taking these old buildings that were built for one purpose and transitioning them over, whether it's the physical challenges or, you know, we're looking at some of the older buildings here, the former May department stores, Famous Bar, Macy's flagship store, financial issues in terms of the massive renovation that has to be done to that. What are the biggest challenges with this transition?
Yeah, it's going to be really difficult, and it's going to take a long time. If you think about these industrial areas, it took a while to convert them to apartments and residential areas. And in those industrial areas, there's a lot of cheap land, and it's pretty easy usually to tear down a factory and build something else. Office districts are really, really, really tough nut to crack. If you want to convert office buildings to apartments, that's often really tricky because office buildings have these giant, deep, dark floors where basically you can have apartments on the outside, but on the inside, there's just no windows, right? No one wants to be in a windowless apartment. So that's a huge issue. You could tear down office buildings and build new, but that's really expensive, especially in dense urban areas where it's, you know, sort of more difficult and expensive to move around construction material. And on top of all that, debt has gotten really expensive, and it's basically become impossible to get construction loans from many banks. So who's going to pay for all that? It's really difficult. And I think the answer is just it's going to take a really long time.
And St. Louis, we've seen a large transition of many of the old buildings that we've got. Just a few are left to be renovated. And it seems like when they're turned over to residential, they fill up relatively quickly. We hear about occupancies at 90% plus in a lot of the high-profile projects. But still, people walk around downtown and the streets seem eerily empty. What's the solution for that? And then, of course, you know, when you have people on the sidewalk, it can help with other issues, everything from filling up the storefronts with retail, with the demand, or driving away criminals with people out on the sidewalks. But how do you get those people on the sidewalks to begin with?
You addressed a really important issue. There's this risk of a downward spiral, right? Where people just don't go to downtown anymore. And then all these shops and restaurants are left without customers. And then they shut down, and then it becomes even more depressing. So fewer people go downtown, and then more shops and restaurants close, et cetera, et cetera. And arresting that spiral is going to be incredibly difficult, right? And cities are trying all sorts of things. One of them is just encouraging businesses to open, for example, by working with landlords to offer below market rents or some sort of revenue sharing arrangement, where basically you fill empty retail space and get in people at below market rents. Another thing that people are trying to do is basically do these open container zones downtown where you encourage people to just be out in the street and have fun. All sorts of things are being tried, like pickleball courts and parking garages or pop-up skating rinks. There's basically cities are trying to make downtowns fun, but it's tough, you know, and you can't just put like a pop-up skating rink and a pickleball court downtown and expect people to all just flood back downtown. It goes back to what we said earlier, right? It's going to take a long time. It's not going to be an easy process.
So what's the role that you found in the places that have seen success of whether it's city government or whether it's, you know, the booster organizations? You talk about, you know, trying to lower rents. Are there public subsidies that have gone into that when it comes to whether it's pocket parks or container zones or turning over parking spots to restaurant seating, you know, less regulation? What do the governments and the booster groups need to do to drive this forward?
Yeah, it's tough to say because it really depends on the city. But I think the places that have been successful have shown a combination of two things. One is just they've had a better position to start with. It's often places that have, you know, a young, educated workforce that get a lot of tourists and visitors that maybe have low taxes in the state or warm weather, those kinds of things. If you have that kind of advantage, it's just easier to turn around your downtown. On top of that, I think the second thing is smart public policy. And again, it depends on the specific circumstances, but that might include, you know, tax breaks for businesses to move downtown or tax breaks for conversions or construction, whatever it might take. But I think ultimately it's going to need both of those, right? Like just throwing tax breaks and subsidies at people is not going to do anything if there are just natural disadvantages to being downtown and people don't want to be there. but just sort of thinking that things will sort themselves out is also not going to work. Clearly, cities are going to have to do something.
Have you seen a lot of metro areas where, you know, in St. Louis, the companies here have embraced, in large part, being in an urban area? We've seen Emerson, Advantage Solutions just moved from California to St. Louis, but they're moving to Clayton, which is our secondary downtown, almost as many tall buildings as the CBD in downtown St. Louis at the Arch. But these companies are not moving to downtown in the city itself. Do you see this kind of within the region competition in other metro areas that hurt downtowns and their ability to come back?
Absolutely. And I think the key here is that companies and young employees actually like downtowns. They just hate these pure office districts. That's the clear distinction, right? And so downtown areas that have a mix of offices and just places where you can have fun are doing well. And as you've pointed out, in many cases, they're actually competing now with these pure office districts. So in Minneapolis, for example, there's a neighborhood called the North Loop, which used to be industrial warehouses, a rail yard, and it's now become, over the years, this more mixed-use neighborhood where you have a lot of offices, but there's also bars and restaurants, and people can live within walking distance. And office buildings there have actually been pretty successful and have been sort of stealing office tenants away from the pure office district, which doesn't really have the same sort of amenities that this neighborhood has. And that's really happening across the country, that you're starting to see this competition between different downtown neighborhoods, where increasingly these pure office districts, which used to be the first neighborhood of choice, are kind of falling behind them.
Conrad Putzier, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us on KMOX.
Thanks for having me.
St. Louis Innovation with Michael and Travis. Nothing impossible on KMOX. Sponsored by Spark St. Louis. Creative space, igniting ideas.
As we continue on KMOX, let's talk with Mike Tipton, the Vice President of Produce and Floral at Schnuck Markets, about a new feature that's coming to the Schnuck's Rewards app. It's called Fresh Produce Now, and it's in partnership with a startup. So, Mike, tell us about this feature and tell us about what you're doing with Foodshed.io.
Absolutely, Michael. Great to be here and great to talk with you about this initiative. As we at Schnuck Markets, we like to give our customers the fresh and freshest product possible. And anytime we can get local product, we like to do that for our customers because we know that how much they enjoy buying the local products at our stores. So this is just layered on to our local program with Foodshed. And Foodshed helps us procure a lot of our local produce through some smaller farms, because not all the farms can get everything we need. So they work with a lot of the smaller farmers to help get our needs throughout the summer months to take care of us on our local needs. And in talking with them, we've come up with this initiative to try to educate our customers and help them know when fresh local produce is arriving at the store they are shopping at. So we have been doing it. We did some test pilots this past summer with Foodshed on some products going to our stores, and where we're tracking the product through the supply chain, and letting customers know that this bin of fresh picked watermelons is arriving at the store that they're shopping at.
So they can turn on this push notification, and the Schnuck's Rewards app will send an alert when the fresh tomatoes arrive?
Yes, they're signed up in the Rewards app, and then the store that they're shopping at, if it's received any of that product that has the traceability in it in the case, it will notify them that they are getting that the product has arrived at their stores, and a little bit about the product when it was harvested and in the farm that it was picked at as well.
Oh, wow. People love to have that kind of granular information, but it's not necessarily available, especially when it comes to this kind of product.
Yeah, this is new. Again, we're testing the waters with it and continuing to learn from it.
Is this available now across the Schnuck Markets network, or are you still piloting this at specific locations?
Yeah, we're still piloting in specific locations, but the thing about it now is there's on the local produce side, as you know, we had a hard freeze last night, so local produce in our area is very limited right now. So this is really something that comes into play next summer during the summer months when all the local fresh fruits and vegetables are coming in.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Well, thank you for joining us for this edition of Nothing Impossible. Always great to talk about what's happening in St. Louis to move the community forward with you, Travis.
And we always talk about what's new, what's next, and we'll do it again next weekend.